Welcome back to The Far Middle, episode 194. We celebrated a birthday a few weeks ago for a legend in the sport of boxing. And that date put him on my dedication hit list, and it's good to finally be able to get to him. I've been an admirer for years. And this is someone who innovated the peekaboo style boxing stance and technique, but also a person who trained multiple greats in the sport across, frankly, multiple generations. And a mentor who developed an impressive tree of trainers who studied under him, and then they went on to pugilistic training greatness. So we dedicate episode 194 to Constantine D'Amato, or as he's better known by, Cus D'Amato. Cus was born into an Italian-American family in New York City, in the Bronx, in 1908. It was a very different world from today's. That's putting it mildly. So paint this picture in your mind. Both of his parents were from southern Italy. His father delivered ice and coal in the Bronx using a horse and cart. And as a kid, Cus D'Amato seriously considered becoming a priest. He was a devout Catholic. And his dad was rough with him and administered beatings as discipline on a regular basis. And Cus would say throughout his life that he was okay with that, and that it made him a better and a more disciplined man. Cus had a brief career as an amateur boxer, fighting as a featherweight and a lightweight, but he was unable to get a professional license because of an eye injury that he suffered in a street fight. Now, the tough upbringing prepared him for the rough and tumble world of the business of boxing. At age 22, D'Amato opened the Empire Sporting Club, and he lived in the gym for years. Now, that's dedication to a craft or a business. His best fighters were routinely poached by, I'll call it, connected managers, as in mobbed up managers. And one fighter that D'Amato discovered was an Italian-American by the name of Rocky Graziano. But then Graziano signed with other trainers and managers, again, mafia affiliated, and then he went on to become middleweight champion of the world. So D'Amato, he gets to the point where, along with his friend, how about this, Howard Cosell, he decides to take on the powerful International Boxing Club of New York, or the IBC, and he refused to match his fighter in any bout promoted by the IBC, and wouldn't you know it, the IBC was eventually found to be in violation of antitrust laws and was dissolved. So he knew what he was dealing with. Cus first struck gold, literally, with legendary boxer Floyd Patterson. Under his tutelage, Cus's tutelage, Patterson followed up his winning the Olympic middleweight gold in the 1952 Helsinki Games with a successful navigation through the pro ranks to become the youngest world heavyweight champion in history at the time. And Patterson was the first Olympic gold medalist to win a professional heavyweight title as well. Some episodes soon we're going to dedicate one to Patterson. He's a worthy subject in his own right, and he was also known as the gentleman of boxing. I had the opportunity to meet him years ago, and I can attest to the gentleman part for his moniker, the gentleman of boxing. D'Amato, he followed up that success with Patterson, with managing light heavyweight Jose Torres to where he became world champ in 65. And after Patterson and Torres, their careers ended. D'Amato worked in relative obscurity, and he was subjected to threats from the establishment of boxing, both the official and the underworld establishment of boxing, and there were both, of course, back in the day. And he sold his New York City gym for a dollar, and he moved to Catskill, New York, where he opened another gym. And there he met a 13-year-old kid in reform school from New York City, and he started to work with him. That kid was future heavyweight champion Iron Mike Tyson. Cus adopted Tyson after Tyson's mom died, and Tyson credits D'Amato with building his confidence and guiding him as a father figure. D'Amato trained Tyson over the following years, encouraging the use of that peekaboo style of boxing that I mentioned, with those hands in front of the face for more protection. And then D'Amato passed away about a year before Tyson became the youngest world heavyweight title holder in history. By the way, ironically, supplanting Patterson's record that Cus helped attain. And Tyson dedicated his belt to what he called his father figure, Cus D'Amato. D'Amato also tutored young trainers, I mentioned that earlier, who became greats in their own right, Teddy Atlas and Kevin Rooney, to be specific. Rooney would guide Tyson to the heavyweight champ title 12 months after D'Amato's death. Cus was revered by legendary writers of the era. That includes Norman Mailer and George Plimpton. His road to greatness, it wasn't smooth. He was arrested. He had his license suspended. He was chased by tax authorities, and he was adjudicated to be bankrupt. And his life was threatened on more than one occasion by the likes of the Mafia, Rocky Graziano, Sonny Liston. And when I say sort of the Mafia, that includes various associates of the five families of New York, the five crime families of New York. Now, if you go down to Lower Manhattan, you're going to find that part of 14th Street, where D'Amato's Gramercy Gym was located, it's now named Custamato Way. And you won't find a figure who had more of an impact on boxing, who loved it more, and who was dedicated to it more, and to whose career spanned a longer time than that of Custamato. We dedicate episode 194 of The Far Middle to him. Custamato was able to cut through the rhetoric of how the peekaboo technique of boxing wouldn't allow that boxer to go on the offensive. And he then demonstrated the technique's efficacy with real-world data and results in the ring of his fighters. Let's compare that rhetoric to data, or perception to facts, that theme, but in another space. So many issues in today's world, particularly those revolving around policy, they seem to rely on the faith of rhetoric and perception instead of building the foundation of the policy on data and facts. And if you've listened to this podcast long enough as a constant listener, you know that one of my areas of interest is in the arena of criminal justice issues, from recidivism to returning citizens to the death penalty. We've covered all of those in prior episodes of The Far Middle. Around New Year's, I came across an article that was one of the most impressive analyses of the prison population and criminal justice system that I've had the pleasure to review. And the piece was written by Paul Robinson and Jeffrey Seaman, and its title was The Myth of Mass Incarceration. Check out what they found. It was very interesting. Surprisingly, America's prison population has been falling for 15 years. In 2022, there were about 350 prisoners per 100,000 American residents. That equates to a total of 1.2 million people behind bars. In 2009, there were 1.6 million incarcerated, so 400,000 more, at a ratio of over 500 per 100,000 residents, a much higher ratio or proportion behind bars. Now, that starting point I gave you in that data set that I just referenced was 2009. I cherry-picked the starting year. If I looked at the 1960 data as the starting point, with that said, we would see that America's prison population was only 212,000, or just 117 prisoners per 100,000 U.S. residents. So in 1960, that ratio of incarcerated was only one-third of today's 350 per 100,000. So why did it go up so much since 1960? And that's where the authors started to dig deep into the data. They looked at what types of crimes and criminals were being incarcerated. And once again, the popular perception was dispelled with data. Today in prisons, you typically are not going to find first-time, say, drug use offenders or shoplifters or even first-time burglars that constitute the population. Drug offenders, they're just 17% of the total prison population, and many, or perhaps most of those, are drug traffickers, very different than drug users. Only 3% of the total prison population has been sentenced for drug possession, and that surprised me, might surprise you as well. So what is the prison population largely made up of then? Well, it's those who have been sentenced for violent crimes or are serious repeat offenders. And that's nothing new, because in 1996, a study found that 94% of state prisoners had either committed one or more violent crimes or had been convicted more than once for nonviolent crimes. Then in 2021, over 60% of state prisoners were convicted of a violent crime. And it's rare to see someone go to prison these days for a first-time nonviolent offense. That has truly become the exception. And that's more true today than it would have been in the past by a wide margin. So then the authors questioned whether sentencing, stricter or longer sentences, maybe they were to blame for the significant increase in incarceration ratio from 1960 to today. But the data show, but for the most part, prisoners are spending less time in jail than they were in prior decades. Now, there are a few notable exceptions. But for all crimes, when you add them all together, the median time served in 1960 was 21 months, whereas recently it was at 16 months. That's a significant decrease. I said there were some notable exceptions. The biggest notable exception was for rape, where in 1960, the median time served for rape was 30 months. Today, it's pushing 90 months. So tougher sentencing laws, whether real or imagined, they've barely affected time served, which was another surprise with those exceptions, such as rape and a few others that I didn't mention. But back to that time served for rape and how that's changed. Very fascinating how society has evolved when it comes to criminal justice issues. Consider this. In 1960, the median imprisoned rapist received less punishment in prison in terms of time served than the median imprisoned robber. Now, today, such a result would make the vast majority of Americans cringe. But back then, the justice system, it literally punished stealing money from someone more harshly than raping someone, which was surprising. Now, something that has seemed to increase time served today versus back then is an increased population of repeat offenders. In 1990, nearly two-thirds of felony defendants had no prior felony convictions, and just over one-third had a prior felony conviction or multiple prior felony convictions. By 2009, the percentage of felony defendants without prior felony convictions dropped to only 40%, which meant 60% had at least one felony conviction, and in many instances had multiple prior felony convictions. So harsher sentencing, it's not driving up the per capita prison population. If that's not sort of the root cause, then what is beyond these multiple sort of offenders? Well, the authors found two other primary root causes: higher crime rates and increased criminal justice system effectiveness. Now, there's more crime today than in 1960. That wasn't too much of a shock to me, but also a criminal is more likely to be convicted of it today than back in 1960. That second root cause was a surprise to me. I wouldn't have thought that to be the case. But between 1960 and 1990, the per capita violent crime rate in the United States, this wasn't a surprise that it went up, but by how much was quite shocking to me. It increased by more than 350%. And in 1960, and this is according to the FBI, just under 3.4 million crimes were reported to police. When you look at new prison admissions that year from reported crimes, 2.6% of reported crimes led to the imprisonment of an offender. So it's sort of a rough metric, not a perfect metric, but a rough metric to measure efficacy of the criminal justice system. Compare that to the FBI data for 2018. In 2018, over 8.4 million total reported crimes, way up, right, from the number in 1960, which was 3.4 million, and approximately 4% of those total reported crimes led to an offender's imprisonment. So there's your answer, a 50% increase in the rate of which reported crime led to imprisonment, coupled with a more than doubling of total reported crimes. That's why the incarceration rate has gone up. And there are subtrends within that bigger trend in data set. Today, we've got much stricter enforcement of laws when it comes to the arenas of domestic violence, rape, which we talked about a minute ago, child sexual abuse. Most Americans would not have a problem with that, including ones who have concerns about our criminal justice system and relatively high incarceration rate compared to prior years. And then there's the contributing root cause factor of shutting down mental institutions over prior decades. In many of those instances, patients found their way onto the streets and into the general population of society and ended up committing crimes in part because of their mental illness. In 1955, the population of state mental hospitals in the United States was over 500,000 people. By 2015, the population of Americans almost doubled, but the number that were in state mental hospitals had fallen by nearly 94% to 35,000 people. So there were consequences to this, many consequences, but one of them, logic tells us, would be crimes perpetrated by the mentally ill once they were effectively released out into society. And look, I'm not discussing this topic to try to defend the criminal justice system or to warrant to you that it's functioning at a very high level of efficiency. Prisons cost America $100 billion a year, and they don't do much rehabilitating prisoners. Almost 70% of released prisoners, they're rearrested within 3 years in the United States. So that's far from a well-functioning system. But let's not make the challenge of correcting it more difficult by ignoring the data and the facts and replacing them with the imposition of rhetoric or perception. Indeed, the analysis that we just covered, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating one, to say the least, but it does lead to more questions than answers to an already confounding situation with our criminal justice system. And I wanted to share it with you. The stats, the statistics of those in prison, indeed, it informs us, and it also dissolves common misperceptions. Let's continue on with that theme to our next connection, which are the data tied to the federal government's decades-long war against poverty. Now, that war started prior to Lyndon Johnson, but of course, it took on exponential focus during his Great Society experiment. And over the years, that focus has remained. Taxpayer dollars expended per poor person has drastically increased. But you know what? For some reason, poverty has not been eradicated or even substantially reduced, at least per the federal government definition of poverty. So here's a number for you. $29,402. What is that? That's the amount that the federal government spent on anti-poverty programs per person in poverty in 2023. And that number, $29,402, it makes some quite conservative assumptions that probably lowers it significantly compared to what the actual number is in reality. Now, anti-poverty programs that are included in that number, what are they? They're Medicaid, all those non-veteran income security programs, things like the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Child Tax Credit, they're in there. The number also includes Supplemental Security Income, Unemployment Comp, Child Nutrition Programs, Family Support Programs. So that's what's in that number. And the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, says that federal outlays for those programs in 2023, they exceeded $1 trillion. It's a big number. And with the $29,402 number, that's what's included. But what doesn't it include? There are some things not included in there, which again, I believe makes it a conservative number. I think the number in reality might be higher. Well, it doesn't include outlays for Medicare or Social Security, old age or disability benefits. And the number was calculated also using the Census Bureau's official poverty definition, which I believe substantially overstates the number of people actually in poverty, because the census does not include most government benefits in the calculation of income. But again, using the Census Bureau's higher population of those in poverty, which would be just under 37 million people, I believe, taking that by the elements included in the expenditure above the line number that we just went over, that gets you to the $29,402 per person in poverty whose income falls below the official poverty line per the government definition. Now, if the amount the federal government spent in the name of citizens living in poverty actually went to those in poverty, if the $29,402 was actually a check that was sent from the government to every person that they define as living in poverty, if that's what actually occurred, there wouldn't be poor people anymore. And unfortunately, we all know that is not the case. So it shows the inefficiency, the non-efficacy of what is in excess of $1 trillion a year in spend, or over $29,000 per person in poverty, how ineffective it is when it comes to actually helping those living in poverty. And I want to thank Dominic Pino for running the story that developed the math we just covered. Excellent job by that journalist. Now, as we search for that answer as to where all that federal government spend is going, if it doesn't fall into the hands of those living in poverty, the ones that it's supposed to benefit, we might consider one culprit as to where all that money's going as the cleanup budget for the National Archives in Washington, D.C. What am I talking about? Well, you see, in February of last year, two climate change activists, in this case, what ended up being two criminals, vandalized the display cases for the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution at the National Archives in D.C. They threw red paint on the cases, and this wasn't their first illegal act. One of these vandals blocked a roadway, another one disrupted activity in the National Gallery of Art. The vandalizing at the National Archives resulted in the two vandals being charged with misdemeanors, but then you know what happened? Something very interesting. An archivist intervened and convinced the Department of Justice to raise the charges to felonies. The archivist at one of the vandals' trial went so far as to give a statement calling for the maximum sentence of 10 years. And here's what that archivist said to the court. "These attacks on museums and the unique treasures of our cultural history that we hold in trust for the nation are not low-level, inconsequential, or victimless crimes. Sending a strong message to clearly establish the significance of these crimes and deter future attacks is essential, not only for the National Archives, but for all cultural institutions across the country." That was in her statement. Hear, hear. The court, by the way, seems to have been swayed by that statement. One vandal was sentenced to 18 months, and the other one received a two-year sentence, and both had to pay restitution to the National Archives for the full cost of the damage. Now, as the new administration in D.C. looks to streamline government and eliminate inefficiencies, I'd suggest that they take a hard look at this archivist at the National Archives. She deserves recognition, a promotion, and consideration as the template for an ideal federal employee who exudes leadership. Kudos to her from the far middle. Looking back over our prior connections for this episode, it seems as if we've fallen upon a theme this week. Facts and reality versus perception and rhetoric, and how differentiating between those pairs can be aided by what I'll reference as the democratization of content creation when it comes to the arena of public discourse. And that was brought to us largely by the magic of social media. So let's make a connection to that topic. FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, revolutionized communication by utilizing radio with his fireside chats to the American people. And then Donald Trump, he revolutionized communications once again by utilizing social media with his tweets to the American people. Two very different styles, to be sure, but both had in common utilizing new modes of technology to control more of their message and to avoid the morphing of that message by the mainstream media. Well, that ability to create your own content and to post your own thoughts on social media your way, that's playing an ever-increasing role in American politics and in the discussion and debate of policies. You don't have to look any further than the 2024 presidential election to see evidence of that. And the mainstream media and its ideological authority figures on the left, they don't like that one bit. And that's why you saw literally a day or two after President Trump being declared winner of the election, you had the hosts of The View insist that it would help if we could regulate social media. And then within a week, President Biden's former press secretary told Katie Couric that disinformation had cost Vice President Harris the election and that to address it, laws had to change. Then you had a prominent figure at Yale post on social media that advertisements from the Trump campaign in battleground states were the equivalent of Russian propaganda and that they should be illegal. A politician in Politico postulated that certain demographics had been prevented from understanding the issues and the candidates by right-wing misinformation machine. An individual at the Brookings Institution said, "We can't ignore the ways in which disinformation shaped views about the candidates and affected how voters saw leader performance." And at another left-wing media outlet, a contributor complained that we're all living inside Elon Musk's misinformation machine now. Now, this all reminds me of when, I believe it was actually Elon Musk, might have been Peter Thiel, I can't remember which one, commented that if Trump could not win in 2024 against what they referenced as the machine, that the machine would always win. And that if the machine always won, we would no longer be a democracy. Well, if that machine is the left running mainstream media, the prior commentary that we just covered went through, blaming the election outcome on misinformation and disinformation, starts to make sense, doesn't it? The revolutionary power of social media and how it democratizes the ability for individuals to post thoughts and content for advocacy is, when coupled with mainstream media's destroyed credibility, an existential threat to the left. And that's why the left, in those major portions of mainstream media controlled by it, are on the warpath when it comes to regulating social media. Well, now we come down the home stretch of episode 194. Sorry to say that, but I'm pleased with the result looking back, and I hope you are as well. Indeed, life informed by data and facts, it's superior to life when it's subjected to policy driven by false perception and rhetoric. So let's wrap up by making a final connection to the facts and data of life on Earth itself. Scientists, whether they're in the field of biology, geology, genetics, they remind us that extinction of a species, that's an important component of progress for life on Earth. Now, that sounds odd, that's counter to our perception, but it is nevertheless true. Death of species on Earth, it's a way of life, literally and figuratively. Science isn't sure about how many species of organisms have existed since life began on Earth. I've seen a few sources referencing a number of 30 billion. There's sources out there citing a number as high as 4 trillion. Scientists just don't know for sure. But what we do know, what scientists are in agreement on, is that 99.99% of all species that have ever lived on Earth are no longer here. They went extinct. As a rule of thumb for complex organisms, the average lifespan of a species is about 4 million years. You want to guess how long humans have been around roaming the Earth? About 4 million years. So our due date might be approaching rapidly upon us. Extinction of species is superior to the overall sustainability of Earth than stagnation of species. Ian Tattersall, he was a prominent figure at the American Museum of Natural History. I think he's still alive. Here's how he puts it. The alternative to extinction is stagnation, and stagnation is seldom a good thing in any realm. Although we've been around for the same amount of time that is about the average for complex species on Earth when extinction comes upon them, let's hope we've got a ways to go before the human race sees game over. And let's also hope that if and when extinction comes for us, it is not via self-extinction from things like nuclear war. Life on Earth for most species is challenging enough as it is, including that for humans. Now, assuming we've got another week to go before our extinction date arrives, stay tuned for a fresh episode in a week. And until then, always stay connected to that far middle.